Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to A Fine Time for Healing, a sanctuary for your emotional well-being. Your host is Randy Fine, author of the memoir Finally, and the inspirational self-help book Awaken from Life. Here's Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in and listening to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk radio show host, Randy Fine. Thinking back, way back, I can remember what it felt like to be a teenage girl. I don't remember it with fondness, and I would definitely not want to experience it again. There were many things going on in my life that made me unhappy. Still, I remember the ups and downs of each day. Each day held some fun and some happiness, and each day also held depression and sadness. I was on an emotional roller coaster. It would have been so helpful to have a mother who could relate to what I was going through and steer me through it with gentleness, wisdom, and support. Someone who understood the girl problems, the boy problems, the self-image problems, the depression, the need to break away and become independent in a safe, gradual progression. My mother tried, but her efforts only made things worse. Her words of wisdom were not comforting. Her support did not feel supportive, and she allowed her own emotions to cloud her guidance. So I parented myself by trial and error, and I did not do a very good job of it. My teens were shaky, and my 20s were even more tumultuous. Instead of maturing and taking the world by storm, I lived with a constant storm inside of me. I tell you this not to bring you down or to gain your sympathy, but to illustrate the importance of parental guidance during a young woman's teen and young adult years. I know what a difference that makes for any child, boy or girl. I parented my daughter entirely different than I was parented myself, and she flourished. She hit the ground running as a young woman, and as a grown woman, continues to prosper in every goal she undertakes. My guest today, Dr. Kelly Tonelli, is a psychologist whose mission is to help teen and young women and those who love them, using her words, figure it out. She authored the book Life Lessons for the Teenage Girl, Quotes, Inspiration, and Advice for Women by Women. I have read her book, and I love the way she addresses each of her topics with personal experiences and advice from accomplished women. And I especially like how she talks the language of her target audience in ways they can easily relate with humor and realism. Young women who read this book will learn so much about navigating their way through the hurdles of life. And I should point out that 50% of all royalties received from book sales go to Children's Hospital Los Angeles. In addition to her authorship, Kelly Tonelli is a California-licensed doctor of psychology in private practice that provides solution-focused treatment aimed at symptom reduction. Her primary focus is on the treatment of children and adolescents. So without wasting any more time, now it is time for me to introduce you to my esteemed special guest, Dr. Kelly Tonelli. Welcome to the show, Kelly, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, what a pleasure. What a pleasure. This is an important show to do. You know, I think it's very important to nurture a young woman's self-confidence. Not so much her appearance, but her confidence, because that's where her self-esteem comes from.
You are completely right. Our self-confidence actually comes from internal. I mean, we definitely reflect on our appearance and how we're treated in the world, but really how we value ourselves is really about who we are inside.
So what can a mother do to help her child, you know, to give her child the confidence and the self-esteem that will help them through life?
Well, and I think this is a challenge. I think a lot of what we're going to talk about today is going to have a lot to do with the idea of balance. Oftentimes, we can be tempted to tell our child that they're the best at everything. You know, you're an amazing drawer, you're a great athlete, you're a beautiful dancer, you're an amazing student, when in fact, that might actually be counterintuitive. It actually sets them up for disappointment as opposed to making them have a strong base of confidence. So, for instance, they can be a great drawer, but it doesn't have to be that you're the best. It can be, I can see you put a lot of effort into this. You really tried really hard. I really appreciate it. I love that you drew this for me. Those kinds of confidence boosters are actually more meaningful than being told, oh, well, you're the best dancer. Because what happens then when they go out into the world and maybe they're not the best dancer or they're not the best artist? It's really important that we focus on, I guess, effort, more so than just on outcome. And we talk through with them when there's a disappointment or when something doesn't go well. Your child comes home with a grade that's lower than had been expected. Then you can have a conversation about, did you try your best? What did you do? What can we learn from this? Excuse me. What can we do differently next time? And it's all about focusing on having then a plan of action about how to address it. Oh, you didn't make the soccer team. Okay, well, what do you think happened? Oh, well, okay, so these kids were better at X, Y, and Z. Is that something that you can work on? And would you like to try out again next year? Or do you want to do something else? It's not, oh, your coach doesn't know what he's talking about, or obviously he has favorites, or anything like that, or, God forbid, oh, well, you're just not good enough, you shouldn't play soccer. Hmm. It's about focusing on coming up with solutions and balancing praise and compliments for when they're actually deserved. Does that make sense?
Oh, my gosh. It makes a lot of sense, and that's really good advice. The other, you know, parents tend to want to fix a lot of what goes on in their children's lives. And when they do that, they create young adults who cannot make decisions and cannot, you know, stand for themselves. Can you speak to that, please?
You're completely right. And I have an almost 10-year-old, and I can tell you, I want to follow her around and just, like, steamroll anybody who does anything remotely mean to her. I want to do that. I want to protect her from the world. But in doing so, I wouldn't be. I would actually be setting her up to be knocked in the face repeatedly by the world. There was a lot of talk for a long time about the idea of the helicopter parent. And the idea was that this parent would do what I just said I wanted to do, follow
right.
their child around and constantly watch to see if there was any kind of crisis that would come up so they could fix it. Interestingly now, there's another term out there, and it's called a lawnmower parent. These are helicopter parents who not only hover around and watch every moment, but then want to do the steamrolling. You know, I'm going to buzz through any problem before my child even experiences it. So the child will never know anxiety or sadness or grief or hurt. But you're right. What would end up happening is you have an adult who doesn't know how to handle it when life throws them things that cause anxiety and sadness and grief and hurt. And this is the time when we can help them process through those things. Okay, so you had a fight with your friend. What happened? You know, who said what? How does that make you feel? What are you going to do about it? Not, I'm going to call her mother, and I'm going to tell her mother, that, you know, Jenny can't say those things to you, or I'm going to go talk to the teacher. It's, okay, child, let's process through. Let's problem solve. Let's brainstorm. Because now I'm going to do it with you in the hopes that someday you'll be able to start doing it on your own.
So there is a time where the mother can intervene and do things, but not to just micromanage and take over for the child.
Yeah, you know, and I think we always need to train. So we're teaching our child how to go through life. Just like we taught them how to walk, we taught them how to talk, we taught them how to dress themselves. We don't just throw them in a room and say, figure it out. But at the same time, we don't help them get dressed when they're 15. We help them get dressed when they're 2 and 3. But as they get older, they start to take more and more independence or autonomy in how they handle their situations. And the same thing goes, it's the same thing for problems in life. The younger they are, the more an active role we play in helping them to process and problem solve and implement that plan. But the older they get, the more that's their responsibility. Now, there are always times when a parent has to intervene. If your child is talking about hurting themselves, if someone at school is bullying them or threatening them, if there's substance kinds of issues going on, at that point, a parent does need to step in. It's not always going to be, well, you know, you're 16, handle it on your own. But we do want to give them an opportunity to handle the situations that are within their power to manage.
Right. Very, very good. Very true. Very true. I think that makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about body image. So having a healthy body image, how can we create that in our daughters?
You know, the first thing we can do is to have a healthy body image ourselves, because we are their role models as far as, you know, the first women that they get to know. And all too often, I will hear a parent come in and say, well, yeah, I've been dieting my whole life. And then their daughter then has an unhealthy body image as well, because what they're constantly hearing is, oh, I'm cutting out the carbs, or I'm cutting sugar, or I look fat in this, or I need to get to the gym. She learns from listening to her mother about what's important, what's valued, what is expected in your body. So the number one thing we can do, first of all, is to be as healthy as we can with our daughters. Secondly, I think it's important to have conversations. In my book, Kat Graham, she's an actress from The Vampire Diaries, talks about how what people see of her isn't real. So, for instance, if she's in a magazine, if she's on TV, there's special lighting, there's a makeup artist, there's a stylist, there's Photoshop sometimes, and that she doesn't want young girls to look at her and go, oh, that is necessarily something that's achievable, because she's like, it's not real. It's not what she looks like in her life. We need to be able to have those conversations with our daughters, that what they're seeing in magazines and on TV and in movies aren't necessarily realistic things that we could even aspire to, nor should we, and that that's not the priority. We need to focus on health, not weight. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So if you have a child that is has a tendency to be overweight, is it just really about introducing healthy foods and that kind of thing, rather than focusing on them losing weight, food and exercise,
well,
you know, good diet and exercise?
Well, sure. I mean, if there's something going on that feels abnormal to the amount of food and things that they're consuming, then you always want to get checked out by a doctor. You want to make sure there's not something medically going on that's interfering with their body's metabolism or whatever. But if it's just the fact that your child has a slower metabolism and that's just kind of how their body is, focusing on the weight actually only breeds, I don't know, oftentimes more of a concern about food or more of almost a focus on food. What a parent ideally will do in those situations is find ways for the whole family to be more active. So it's not just, I keep saying Jennifer, but I'm going to call her Jennifer again. It's not just, oh, Jennifer needs to start doing sports or Jennifer needs to be more active. No, it's let's go for a family bike ride. Let's go to the park and run around. Let's go do things together. Oh, you like to dance? Great, we'll sign you up for some dance classes. And at the same time, having healthy foods in the home and not having so much of those junk kinds of foods available. Kids will eat what's there. And a lot of times parents will tell me, oh, but she won't eat that. Well, if that's the food that's available, she's going to eat it. Kids will not starve. But at the same time, you also don't want it to be like, no, you can never have a Dorito. Because that becomes then almost kind of a hoarding behavior. When I have access to them, I'm going to eat as many as I can, because otherwise, who knows when I'm going to get it again. So we want it to be the idea of moderation. Yes, we can occasionally, of course, have a cookie. Of course, we're going to occasionally, it's a birthday party, we're going to have a piece of cake. But in general, as a rule, we're going to have healthy choices at home. And the whole family eats those healthy choices, not just Jennifer.
Right. Very, very good. That's a great answer. Teenage girls are very moody. They're going through a lot of hormone changes and everything. And they have unpredictable, you know, outbursts. And, you know, how is a parent supposed to handle that?
Well, and I think I remember my teenage years, and I remember being moody, and I remember all the angst that went with it. One of the things I remember most is feeling out of control, you know, recognizing that my moods didn't always match the situation, and it's feeling scary and overwhelming and all of that. So I think the number one thing a parent can do is acknowledge it. And I'm not talking about in like a teasing kind of way or a punitive way, but so much can be done for just saying, gosh, it seems like you're having a really bad day. What's going on? And the kid might tell you, nothing, leave me alone. Okay, well, if you want to talk about it, let me know. And it's important to notice when it's an okay day, because then you're going to have great conversations like, I noticed yesterday you were having a really hard day. And, you know, child usually will acknowledge it if they're in a good mood today. Okay, well, I want you to know I'm really sorry that you had a bad day, but we do need to talk about the fact that you can't take your bad days out on the family. That's not going to be okay. So what can we do when you're having a bad day to help you? These are not good conversations to have in the moment when the kid's already upset, because then it's nothing, you don't understand, nothing will help. But if you can have that conversation when there's a decent mood going on, a lot of times they can come up with suggestions. You know, I can go for a walk. I'll go outside and pet the dog. Give me 20 minutes upstairs to listen to music. Whatever their suggestions are. And then the next time if they're having a rough day, which will probably be the next day, you can say, remember that conversation we had? Maybe, would you like to go listen to music? Do you want to go for a walk with me? Should we go take some dog time? It may not work every time, but it's good for them to get the idea of, what do I do when I'm having a bad day to manage my mood?
Right. I agree. You know, when my daughter... It's also important to be a really good listener. When my daughter went off to college, she used to call me because there was no text, and she didn't, well, I guess she had a cell phone, but whatever, she would call me, and she would tell me all these bad things that happened in the course of the day, you know. And my tendency was to want to say, oh, we'll do this, we'll do that. And she learned to say, Mom, I'm just venting, which meant I just want to say it and have you listen to me. But there's nothing I really want to do about it. So
well,
I learned to be a really good listener.
The difference, right?
Yeah, it's really important. We can't fix everything. Sometimes they just want to say it. And we can't react. Our reactions can really create more problems for them. Isn't that true?
It's completely true. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we can do for our children in general, teenage daughters especially, but is to become a better communicator. And part of that with them is just being an open communicator. That means that they can come to you and talk about things, and we'll check our reactions at the door almost. Now, this is, again, one of those things that we talked about before with balance. We can't be their best friend. We're still their mom. We still need to be their mom, and there still needs to be limits and expectations. And so it's not like she's going to come home and tell you that she did all these drugs the night before and you're going to go, oh, great. Do you have fun? I mean, no. But if she comes and talks to you about drugs, the ideal reaction would not be, what are you thinking? And screaming and yelling. And even though that's what's going on in your mind you might be screaming, oh, dear God, what are you doing? But your response needs to be, I have concerns about that. Or what did you think about it? Are you going to do that again? What do you think is going on? You know, and have the conversation about what they're telling you. I have found that the more open we can be to what they want to tell us, the more they're going to want to tell us.
That's right. When we react, we shut them down. And I always felt, you know, raising my children, that that was the most important thing, was not to react, because I wanted to keep them safe. And the way I could keep them safe was to have them be open with me and tell me and not be afraid to tell me. So I never reacted. You know, we handled it, but, you know, reactions, I think my mother was highly reactive, and I just got to the point where I lied to her all the time because I didn't want to deal with it, you know. I either didn't tell her or I made up stories.
Sure. Oh, no, it's a
yeah.
Then you tell stories about a friend, and it's not really you.
Right.
You're right. It shuts them down. They're afraid of your response. They're afraid that they're going to get in trouble, or that you're going to be disappointed in them, you're going to be angry, you're going to tell other people, whatever it is. If they're afraid to come to you with information, they just won't.
That's right. How do you deal with, you know, a teenage girl and sexual issues? Because obviously she's having those urges.
Absolutely. Well, and I think those conversations start when they're so young. And I'm not talking about like sexual detail kind of conversations, but you start having talks about bodies and all of those kinds of things at an age appropriate level from the beginning. So, you know, for instance, my daughter, we were at a store when she was 4 or 5, and they had a tampon dispenser, and she wanted to know what that was. So I gave an age appropriate response to what that was, how it was related to puberty in general. She was like, oh, okay. You know, a couple years later, she asked a few more questions, and we've kind of had those types of conversations as we've gone. You know, she'll see people kiss in movies and that kind of thing. I think you want to have an open door policy, basically, for any kind of conversation about her body, her feelings, any of those things. And the hardest part is not to look uncomfortable, to make it seem as if, oh, this is no big deal, we can have this conversation, like you said, not to react. The difficulty can be a lot of families, a lot of moms will have certain moral positions about sex, sexuality, when it's okay, when it's not okay, what is okay, and it's hard not to want to push those on our daughters. I think we have to share them, though. You know, if a family has a specific religious position, you know, for instance, if they feel that sex only should occur within a marriage, I think that information is conveyed to the daughter, of course, because the family probably talks about their religion in a number of ways. But at the same time, there almost needs to be an awareness that she may not operate the same way and that there will still be love for the child. And I'm not saying
Great
you're
point.
Giving permission
Great point.
Per mm-hmm. se, but I think it can be difficult because a lot of times people, not just people who are religious by any means, but people will have a certain position, and there's almost a feeling in the child that if I don't follow this same position, I'm going to be cast out, I'm going to be a disappointment, I'm not going to be loved anymore. And I think that can really interfere then with the idea of having healthy communication with your child. This has come up a lot in my practice in regards to sexuality as far as whether someone is gay or straight. I have a number of teens who do not come out to their parents out of fear that they'll be rejected. And a lot of that has to do with conversations that parents have had either with the child or in the child's presence where they kind of condemned people who were gay or bisexual or different in any way. And so the child then interprets that, if I am gay, if I tell my parents I'm gay, they're not going to love me anymore. In which case the child then begins to lie and to hide. And a lot of times there can be some really self-injurious behaviors.
Yeah, I agree. My son had a friend in high school, and they went to college together. But while this boy was in high school, I guess he was struggling with his sexual identity. And he actually mm-hmm. made a little video of him actually telling his father, "Dad, I'm gay." And every time he would say, "Dad, I'm gay," his father would say, "Oh, stop it. You know, you're not gay." And he'd go, "But Dad, I am gay." And he would be kind of kidding, you know, as he said it. And the father would say, "Oh, cut it out, you know. Stop saying you're gay." Well, this kid ended up with so many problems. He became a heroin addict. I mean, all kinds of things. His father refused to accept it. And it was so obvious to everyone that the kid was gay. So what, you know? But isn't that tragic?
You know, it really is. And I do see a lot of that kind of pattern that can go on. If, you know, whether it's sexual identity or if it's, I don't know, religious positioning or anything, if a child, say, will not be accepted for who they really are by their parents, by their loved ones, a lot of times what they end up doing is trying to find alternate behaviors to cope, which can be drugs and alcohol, it can be promiscuity, it can be a number of things, in which case they really sabotage their own successful life functioning. The parent also oftentimes, you know, this dad probably knew. He probably had a pretty strong inkling. But a lot of times there's this idea of if I don't admit it, if I don't have the conversation, then it's not really true, and there's that small chance that it's still possible that he's just joking.
Mm-hmm.
If he would have looked at his son and said, okay, we keep having this conversation. Are you joking or are you not joking? Then he would have actually had to deal with the reality of what was going on with his son.
Right.
I have to think, or I hope, he would rather have a gay son than a son who's a heroin addict.
You
but
would
a lot
think
of
so.
Times there's I would hope so. But a lot of times there's this almost kind of fear of what does this mean for my child's future? Just by virtue of being different than what we would consider the average. Or they have this kind of vision of their child's future. They picture someday a wedding with a wife and a picket fence and 2.5 grandchildren and all of that. And acknowledging the fact that my son or daughter is gay means that that plan changes. That doesn't have to be completely different. I know plenty of gay couples who are married and have children and have a white picket fence and all of those things. But a lot of times it's very hard when things are different than you expect.
Right. You know, if you're not an accepting person, if you can't accept your child and you're either living vicariously through them or you have high expectations for perfection or whatever, it's such a huge disservice to your child. What do you do if your daughter's hanging out with bad influences? What, you know, with bad crowd, bad influences, and you just know it's going down the wrong path?
And I think that is such a struggle because I think a lot of parents try to do the, you are forbidden to hang out with Jennifer. Poor Jennifer. She's under the bus. I refuse to let you hang out with Jennifer. Jennifer is bad. Well, what ends up happening then is almost like a Romeo and Juliet kind of friendship. We know Romeo and Juliet, you know, the more that their parents tried to tear them apart, the more they clung to one another. That happens with friends too. So a lot of times it's the appeal of that person is that they're kind of a rebellion and things like that. What I often recommend is trying to get to know that group. Try and make your house not the party house, not by any means. You're not going to go out and buy alcohol and all of that so they hang out at your house. But you do want your house to be a place where your child and their friends can hang out relatively comfortably. That gives you an opportunity to get to know these kids better. You might find out, hopefully, that they're not as bad as you thought. A lot of times we get the perception based on how kids dress. So if they're dressing all in dark clothing and things like that, people go, oh, they're emo, they're dangerous, they're all of these things. You might find out, no, that's just a style preference. That isn't their personality or any kind of indicator of their behavior. But if you get to know these people and you find out, no, I'm justifiably concerned, what I would recommend is then trying to find ways to encourage other friendships, whether that be helping your child to look for a job. Because at work, they get to know other people and they hang out with them. Get involved in activities, get involved in hobbies, sports, music, whatever. So if your child is not an athlete but is really into music, okay, let's start doing guitar lessons. Let's start learning how to play the drums. Most parents don't like the drums because they're loud, but if it gets your child away from that element, great. It's really about less of forbidding that friendship as it is about encouraging other friendships. So when I was in middle school, I think, there was a girl my mother hated her with a passion that could not be understood. And at the time, I had no clue why. I was like, oh, she's great. I don't know what you're talking about. You know, we have a great time together. She's fabulous. Well, now looking back, my mom was right to be concerned. All the things that I thought made this girl exciting and fun were bad things. You know, her mom would buy alcohol for everybody. She shoplifted. You know, she was relatively promiscuous for a middle schooler. All of those things. My mom was pretty smart about it, though. What it was, okay, she would encourage that girl to come over to our house and hang out. She did not allow me to hang out at her house with her mother because her mother was questionable. And my mom and I talked enough that she knew. I would share things about this girl's mom with my mom. And eventually, the friendship kind of faded because those things that made her fun and exciting started to get kind of, I don't know, overwhelming, I guess. That level of drama, that level of constant stimulation was a bit too much. And I just kind of gravitated toward the other friendships. Didn't help that she got arrested, too. But, but it was
I had friends like that, too. My mother used to call one of my girlfriend's houses the opium den. I don't know why she called it that. She didn't know anything. She said, you're not going to that opium den, are you?
And you were like, no, not going there. Well, I would start to tell fibs, too. You know, Dawn would have a party at her house. And my mom would be like, oh, no, you can't go. Oh, okay, well, then I'm going to go to this person's house instead. Mm-hmm. And I'd end up at, you know, the party.
Then you go anyway, right.
Yes, of course I did. So my mom realized, okay, that's not working. Now all I'm doing is having you sneak around behind my back. Why don't we invite her to our house? And, you know, hopefully by her getting to know my mom, she would be less prone to pull me into bad stuff. Oftentimes these people tend to fade away, too. She ended up getting expelled from our middle school and going to some Catholic school somewhere. And you know, junior high, you don't have cars and ways to get in touch. And if you're not seeing each other all the time, it kind of fades away. So we were lucky.
Right, that's
true. But it
true.
Really is about encouraging more positive pro-social relationships, supporting those interests more so than it is about forbidding the other. I think it's great to have the conversations. So if you know this friend is into drugs, if you know this friend is really promiscuous, if you know anything about that, I think it's a great conversation to have with your child. Here are my concerns. I know this about your friend. What do you think about this? What do you think about her behaviors? Do you think they're okay? It's a great time to actually have a discussion based on what your child thinks and feels.
Right. We can plant the seeds in their head and, you know, and have that open dialogue. And eventually, I guess, they come to their own senses. I also wanted to ask you about things that affect them permanently, like piercings and tattoos. How do we deal with that?
Well, that is a great question. A lot of that has to do with kind of your personal belief system, first and foremost, about piercings and tattoos. I know a lot of the parents who have them themselves, and so they may be less concerned about it. My issue with it is always the clothes that I would have chosen to wear at 15, I would not be caught dead in now. My preferences have changed. My style has changed. So much about me is different than it was when I was 15. So my ability to choose a tattoo at 15 that I'm still going to like when I'm 35, 40, 45 is really unlikely, and that's just not possible. So I think it's important to have those types of conversations about what your feelings are about tattoos, what your feelings are about piercings. If your child comes to you with something, having the discussion of, well, why do you want it? What is it about it? The good news is most piercings, if you take them out, there's no major mark. I know there's a big pull right now with plugs in the ears, you know, that make the extra
right,
big
the gauges.
Holes.
Yeah.
Gauges, perfect. Those I'm more concerned about than I am about piercings. Because those don't grow back. If you take out your gauges after a period of time, you're going to end up with a big hole in your ear, the size of whatever gauge your earring was. Those are harder. When I was I went to college on a mommy full ride scholarship. My mother said, my parents said, we will pay for undergrad. I was very, 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 very lucky. And I was aware that I was very lucky. While I was there, I decided I wanted to get a tattoo. My concern was, if I get a tattoo, even though I was 19, I'm legally allowed to, I can make my own decision. My concern was, they're paying for college. I felt as if I owed them the conversation. So I called my mom on my little dorm phone, because cell phones were not popular then. And
right.
I talked to her about it. And she was like, okay, well, where would you put it, and why would you put it there, and what are you thinking about getting, and why would you pick that? And we had a long conversation about it, and then she kind of gave me what were her rules. It had to be smaller than the bottom of a Coke can, so she didn't want it to be big. It had to be somewhere that if I were dressed professionally, it would not show. So she didn't want it on my ankle. She didn't want it on my wrist, you know, not my neck. It had to be somewhere that it wouldn't be seen professionally. And those were her rules. She's like, if you do those things, and if it's the only one, because tattoos can be addicting. People get one, and all of a sudden they start getting itching for two and three and four. And I say this because I have a little sister who has both arms sleeved now. So those were her rules. And I was like, okay, I can do that. So I have one tattoo on my shoulder, kind of back shoulder kind of area, and kind of on the blade. And it's exactly, by the way, the size of the bottom of a Coke can, because I had him trace it. And then he fitted in that spot. I can tell you now, 20-odd years later, I wish I didn't have it. I don't like it anymore. If I were to get a tattoo today, which I'm not going to, it would be something completely different. So I think we have to set guidelines with our children based on what we think and believe. We have to have conversations about it. I think it was great that she set parameters, because when I was tempted to get a second one, because they are addicting, I had friends who had several, I thought about the fact that, no, mom said this was okay. One, I have to stop at one. My stepdad, until he passed away, referred to me as scarred and marred because of my tattoo. Every picture that was ever I was ever in where you could see it at all, he would circle it and send it to me. Yes, he loved my tattoo. But I can say it was also done in jest. It was not an angry conversation. It was not shaming. It was not mean. It was not mean-spirited. He was a peeping fellow by nature.
Okay.
But it's important to have those conversations. I don't think those things should be done prior to 18. I mean, there's a reason that legally you're supposed to be 18. But I know it happens. I would rather your child come and talk to you about it than have a friend do it. I've seen that happen. I had a client who was doing illegal tattoos on his friends. He had no training. He had no experience. There certainly was no medical knowledge about how not to spread diseases and things like that. This is part of that open communication. I want your children to come to you and say, I'm thinking about this. Okay, well, let's talk about it. I'm not going to react. I'm going to have a conversation about where do you want to put it? Why do you want it? How about if we wait until, if you're 19 and you still want that exact same thing, we'll go, I'll take you. I'll take you and we'll do it together. I think it's great to avoid the impulsivity that teenagers are known for and to say, okay, well, today is April 12th, 2015. If on April 12th, 2016, you want the same tattoo, we'll talk about it and I'll take you if they're 18. Those kinds of conversations, because chances are 12 months later they're going to want something different, in which case you can say, okay, well, that's what you want now. Let's wait 12 months. If you still want that same design, we'll talk about it.
That's great advice, Kelly. That's really great advice. When my son, you know, I'm so adamant about it. When my son was getting ready to go to college, you know, I said to him, you're 18. You're going to college, and now you can make decisions for yourself. I said, but I want you to know that we're paying for college, and should you just go out and get a tattoo, you will end up having to pay for your own college. So it's very similar to kind of your discussion. And he never did it. He never did it, but the gauge thing sort of started to come into play. He started getting wider and wider with his gauges, but not huge. you know. And I said, it finally got to a point where I said, okay, that's wide enough. That can be, that can heal back up. But my next door neighbor, her son had to have surgery when he went out into the work world because of his earlobes.
Well, exactly. Well, and the thing is, you know, I think corporate America has become a lot more accepting. They're not as freaked out by the idea of having employees with gauges or having, you know, visible tattoos and things like that. But at the same time, you have to think you're making a permanent change to your body that's visible to the world. And it's a permanent change that you may not always want. So it's not just, whether or not I can get a job now that I've got this huge gauge that's a sign of, you know, the size of a rubber ball. But it is about, will I still like it? And you're right, it becomes surgery. They end up having to have plastic surgery to have their ear restored to kind of what would be more of a typical shape.
Right. You know, we're getting close to the end of time, and I really want to give you an opportunity. If you could just take about, you know, like 2 minutes and maybe talk about what you do, your book, and how you can be contacted.
Okay, well, let me tell you a little bit about the book. As you said, I work with teen girls, and so I was noticing they weren't listening to anybody adult in their lives. Parents didn't understand, and teachers were old and all of that. But what they were doing is giving me little snippets of information that they were gleaning from social media and things from their favorite celebrities. So I thought, rather than it just being about how to get the guy and how to look good and how to lose weight, what if I could get those famous, successful women to give meaningful advice, something that actually would be helpful? And so then I started contacting them. Many of them were amazing and did so and offered me all kinds of pieces of information. I then supported them with psychological advice and activities and exercises, and that became Life Lessons for the Teenage Girl. Do a lot of speaking about that book and with teen girls, and I really, really enjoy it. The easiest way people to get a hold of me, my blog is one way, and that's psychobabblechat.com, or through Twitter, which is BR, not spelled out, _ Tinelli. Or, you can go to my Facebook page. There's a Life Lessons for the Teenage Girl page. Any of those ways, I'd love to hear any thoughts people might have about the book, or I can help steer them to the book, which is available with Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all of those types of places.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, I recommend anyone who has a teenage daughter to get this book and let your daughter read it, because it is so on the level, and Kelly is so honest about her past, which I really believe is important. I think when you humble yourself, when you share what you've done, it makes others more receptive, makes, you know, young people more receptive to what you have to say. Because they know you've been through it. You're not just talking, you know, from an adult point of view. So I think this book is wonderful. So I highly recommend that. We only have about 2 minutes left. So I do want to say thank you so much for being on the show and offering us this tremendous advice. It's just all so important.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, it has been fun. All right, Kelly. Well, thanks again, and have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. So we're out of time for today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, please email me at loveyourlife@randygfine.com. loveyourlife@randygfine.com. All my shows are archived after broadcasting and can be listened to at your convenience on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, or through the show links on my website. Thanks again for tuning in and listening to A Fine Time for Healing. This is Talk Radio show host and author Randy Fine, signing off until next time. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about Randy at her website, Randy G. Fine. RANDIGFINE.com. Join her next time for more of A Fine Time for Healing.
Hard not to hesitate, but we can't wait to be.